this episode of Modern Practice, we'll continue our discussion about elective surgeries and the opportunities involved with documentation on them. I'm your host, Dr. Tomas Villanueva, Senior Principal for Performance Improvement Consulting and Practicing Internist. Joining me is Rachel Mack, RN, Consulting Director for Clinical Documentation Improvement at Vizient. Rachel, welcome back.
Glad to be back, Tom. Thank you.
When certain elective procedures are due to an active infection going on, so any comments to that that we need to understand?
Yes, Tom. So I'm really glad you brought that up. I have a whole spiel about deep diving into the focus of infection prevention for our elective surgical patients, starting with this in the preoperative space. What I mean by this is working up patients to make sure they don't have an insidious or brewing preoperative infection. And the most common culprit, especially in our Medicare patients, is going to be a UTI. So one of the PSIs, and the reason that I shout this from the rooftops, one of the PSIs that is closely tracked for inpatient hospital stays is Patient Safety Indicator 13. And the name of that is simply postoperative sepsis rate. The objective of this PSI is to capture elective surgical patients that develop postoperative sepsis as a secondary diagnosis. This PSI exists. It's basically Medicare's way of saying, hey, you shouldn't be giving elective surgical patients sepsis postoperatively. And there's a lot we can do, again, as you know, in the inpatient space to prevent this. So I do have some facts about postoperative sepsis, and they are terrible, just FYI. So approximately about 1.2 to 4.1%, I couldn't find a tried and true number, just kind of some ranges, but 1.2 to 4.1% of our elective surgical patients go on to develop postoperative sepsis. Once they develop postoperative sepsis, those patients have a 25% mortality rate, which is just terrifying. Abdominal procedures have the highest mortality rates, again, once that patient has that postoperative sepsis. Abdominal procedures have the highest rate, around 3%. Non-cardiac thoracic procedures have one of the highest mortality rates for postoperative sepsis patients at almost 46%. Also, JAMA has a great article. It's called The Costs of Postoperative Sepsis: The Business Case for Quality Improvement to Reduce Postop Sepsis in VA Hospital Patients. They found that the average unadjusted cost for patients with no sepsis across the board for surgery was about $25,000, whereas the average cost for patients with postoperative sepsis was 3.5 times higher at $88,000. And that in risk-adjusted analyses, the relative costs were over 2 times greater for patients with post-op sepsis. So all of that being said, if an elective surgery patient is admitted and they develop sepsis postoperatively, and if it is documented and captured, that's it. That patient falls into, they're a victim of PSI 13. But there are a few things from a CDI perspective, from a coding perspective, and a quality perspective that we can do and try to appropriately remove this PSI. And so one of the things I always tell CDI specialists is deep dive into this patient's preoperative story. So again, Tom, I got a story for everything always, but last year I was reviewing a case. This patient became essentially violently ill after elective surgery and developed what I call raging sepsis. This was not soft sepsis criteria. This was temps of 104, heart rate in the 150s that wasn't AFib, white blood cells of 30, you know, all the things, whether they were using sepsis 2 criteria or the SOFA criteria. Went back and looked at this patient, she was a female, at her preoperative workup. She had a urinalysis done that came back funky, right? Had something growing. Because of the outpatient facility's rules and regulations, they sent that UA off for culture. It came back positive for E. coli. Do you think anyone caught that? Do you think it was treated? And the answer, unfortunately, in this case was no. This patient had an E. coli UTI prior to an elective surgery, and it fell through the cracks. It just did, which led this patient, again, her blood cultures postoperatively grew E. coli. So again, do I think this happens all the time? Absolutely not. I do not. But I do think that We have these lovely EMRs. We have 1,000 different ways to communicate with each other. And somehow that has created even more holes in the Swiss cheese when it comes to patients and things falling through the cracks. So again, my education, whenever you've got a post-op sepsis patient, an elective post-op sepsis patient, really deep dive and see, did they have a brewing infection prior to surgery that nobody knew about? Again, is it going to be common? No. Does it happen? Unfortunately, yes. So if with PSI 13, if we can get an infection documented as present on admission, that will kick that patient out of that PSI. And some of the infections, I'm not going to go through all of them. There is a hundreds page PDF out there on the government website on AHRQ. You can go look at it. But pneumonia, any and all pneumonias will kick us out. Cystitis, not even just a UTI, but cystitis, UTIs, pancreatitis, probably pretty rare. If a patient has some type of infection related to their arthritis, that will kick us out. Another very overlooked one, a very common one, are skin infections like a cellulitis or an abscess or diabetes. You asked about diabetes specificity earlier, diabetes with gangrene. Any of those being present on admission. Also, and this is just kind of a funny one, we don't think of adults getting this, but they do actually had one recently, ear infections and otitis media will kick us out of PSI 13. The bummer, besides the huge bummer of PSI 13, we don't want any patients experiencing this, but one of the bummers of PSI 13, unfortunately, is COVID-19 is not one of the infections that will kick you out of this PSI.
That's crazy.
It is crazy, whether it's present on admission or not present on admission. So just something to think about.
It is, because considering the data shows that the surgical outcomes are worse among COVID-positive patients.
Absolutely.
So, Rachel, this actually brings up a very good point in the case that here's another one of those examples where we keep on preaching here at Vizient the importance of having your quality folks and your CDI folks have a dotted line to one another, because you can actually appropriately avoid a PSI if you actually look out for some of these outcomes or some of these preoperative findings, whether it be a cystitis or something that you may not have considered.
Absolutely, Tom. And what I find, that dotted line is very important, because what we typically see is a lot of CDI specialists, they know how to maximize a case appropriately. They know how to risk adjust. They know how to query. They know how to review a record. What they don't know is all of the ins and outs of rules related to all the PSIs. It is so much information to keep up with, and it is quite literally thousands of pages of information that gets updated every year as well, right? As soon as you get good at it, they change the rules. So CDI is really good at doing their part of the job, but they're not great at asking for those exclusion diagnoses. What I find with quality is quality knows those exclusion diagnoses like the back of their hand, but they're not used to the record review that CDI does. They're not used to querying. Most quality programs don't query. And so I find that dotted line, that teamwork of quality saying, hey, this case is in PSI 13. We're sending it to CDI and coding for a second review. Can you be on the lookout for this? That is usually what works best. And I hate to say 9 times out of 10, but at least occasionally, I'd say 3 times out of 10, can appropriately kick this patient out of whatever PSI they fell into. So teamwork, again, being cheesy, but teamwork really does make the dream work in CDI coding and quality.
How about PSI 7?
Oh, the lovely PSI 7. So I want to loop into, one, I'll explain it, and two, why that preoperative workup is so important to prevent PSI 7. So PSI 7 is called CVC-related bloodstream infection rate. And we've got a lot of great people at Vizient who work very closely with hospitals to try and prevent as many of these as humanly possible by good line care, education, all the things. So the thing about PSI 7 that's really interesting, and you kind of have to split it in half in your head. Let's say a patient does get a CVC-related bloodstream infection. Womp womp, right? It is what it is. They've got the infection. No matter what, if that infection falls into XYZ for the NHSN, that CVC-related bloodstream infection, that is going to be reported to the NHSN. That's all there is to it. However, for the PSI, there are some really cool, I'd say cool, I'm such a nerd, sorry, Tom, but there's some really cool stuff that CDI encoding can do or query for, or just make sure that they code, that will kick that patient out of PSI 7. That infection is still going to get reported to the NHSN no matter what. right? CDI coding, we can't do anything about that. That just is what it is. But with chronic conditions, some really weird ones, if we can get those documented and established and final coded for the record, that will kick the patient out of PSI 7. So I've got many here. It's a group of diagnoses that CMS calls immunocompromised state. And it is not all just the obvious ones. Things like CKD stage 5, end-stage renal disease, HIV disease, immunodeficiency, severe malnutrition, neutropenia, pancytopenia of all sorts. And if a patient's had a transplant, these are examples of ICD-10 diagnoses that if we can get them established, and they don't even have to be present on admission, they can code. The patient can develop this after surgery. That will kick the patient out of PSI 7.
Rachel, thanks for the insights. And I look forward to continuing our discussion on the next episode. And to our listeners, you can contact Rachel at her email address posted in the research section. And if you have any additional questions pertaining to modern practice or simply want to send us your comments, please contact me at our email, modernpracticepodcast@vizientinc.com. And please join us for other Modern Practice Podcasts. Subscribe today, like us, or send us your comments. And now, I'm Dr. Tomas Villanueva. Thank you so much for listening.